Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Third hour is on, and I'm joined in studio by Joel Webbin. You can follow him on X at Joel Webbin, nxrstudios.com. Is where you can find NXR, which is also on Rumble, NXR Studios. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Harrison, thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you. You have a new book out called The Hyphenated Heresy, Judeo-Christianity is the subtitle. We all want to get into this and how it applies to everything going on in the world today. But I want to go to a video of yours that's gone pretty viral recently, clip number five. This went actually totally viral. We'll play it, and then we'll comment a little on the other side.
We just posted it yesterday, and so it's only been like 24 hours, but it's already getting a lot of views.
Picking up steam for good reason, because this is a conflict at the heart of our entire society at this point. Here's Joel Webbin with a video comparing Jews to Christians, right?
That's right.
Here it is.
Stop quoting our scriptures to us. The Old Testament belongs to Christ and to his Christians, his joint heirs, not to you. You reject Jeremiah, who promised a new covenant in which God would forgive sin and remember iniquity no more. You reject Hosea, who proclaimed that God would call his son out of Egypt. You reject Malachi, who foretold the Lord suddenly coming to his temple, preceded by the messenger who would prepare the way. You reject Balaam, who foresaw a star and a scepter rising out of Jacob. And you reject Solomon, who sang of a king whose dominion would be extended to the ends of the earth and that would endure forever. And you reject Asaph, who proclaimed that God would reject false shepherds and raise up his own chosen king to shepherd faithfully his people in righteousness. You rejected all the prophets. You stoned them. You built tombs and sepulchers to honor them in order to try to whitewash the blood off of your hands. But you rejected them all then, and you still reject them now. God does not listen to you. God does not hear your prayers. And I am deeply and profoundly sorry that any Christian has dared to imply that we worship the same God. Because your God is not Yahweh. Your father is the devil. Your synagogues are erected in his honor, synagogues of Satan. I'd point out that God tires of your feast and rejects all your sacrifices, but Christ Almighty actually destroyed your temple by divine decree, and you have not offered a single legitimate Jewish act of worship in 1,955 years. So today, you have a choice. You can worship your Messiah and bow down to your king, or you can be about tidying Jerusalem and sweeping Israel. You can care for our holy sites and polish our relics, because one day soon, the Christ whom you crucified is returning to reclaim his earthly home and turn you into a footstool for his feet and to rule over you with a rod of iron. His first act will be to evict every last unbelieving Jew and Muslim from the Holy Land at the tip of his own sword, so as to not sully it with the presence of your unbelief. Oh, but you're the chosen ones. No, you're not. We are. Christians are. Do you not know your own supposed scriptures? Have you not read God spoke through Malachi, declaring that he would reject your sacrifices entirely and take his name to the Gentiles instead? Have you not read in Jeremiah, who quotes God promising to tear down a nation that he planted if it persists in evil, and to build another if it obeys? Christians are the children of Abraham, while unbelieving Jews have been cut off. So while I appreciate your noble effort to lecture Christians about why replacement theology is wrong, I reject the premise that you even believe the Old Testament itself. For if you did, then you would believe in Christ and joyfully declare that Christ is King.
Yes, folks, that, in my opinion, was a very well-said expression of basic biblical theology. And the sad thing is, people are outraged at that. But that is what the First Amendment is for. You can be outraged, but we can be critical. On the other side, we get into it with Joel Webbin, and we'll get into everything that was just said and his new book, The Hyphenated Heresy, available now. Stay with us, folks.
Energy shots have been all the rage for decades because they really work. but most of them are full of dyes and toxic stimulants and have huge crashes. We set out to develop a product at thealexshieldstore.com that has all the very best adaptogens, nootropics to biohack your body and not just help your brain, but every cell in your entire body. We've done it, ladies and gentlemen. Mind Fuel is next level with no letdown, no crash. It is very strong. So I take half a shot in the morning, half in the afternoon, and it's just amazing. And again, the effects go on for days and days and days because these are super nutrients that are in Mind Fuel. For the time I have here, I can't tell you all the incredible ingredients. So go to thealexshieldstore.com and look at what is in it. And of course, proprietary herbal ingredients as well. Go now to thealexjonesstore.com and secure your Mind Fuel and be the reason we'll always be on the air. Thank you so much for your support. If you love our other products, you're going to love Mind Fuel.
Dismantling the globalist agenda hour by hour. This is the War Room with Harrison Smith.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Joel Webbin is my guest. He's here with me in studio. His new book is called The Hyphenated Heresy, Judeo-Christianity. That's the hyphen there in the middle of Judeo and Christianity. You can follow Joel on X at Joel Webbin, on Rumble at NXR Studios and NXRstudios.com. He is a father, a husband, a pastor who serves at the senior pastor of Covenant Bible Church in Texas. He's the president and founder of Right Response Ministries, where he produces daily content focused on biblical teaching, theology, and cultural issues. Of course, you also gaslight as a, or no, is that the right word? Moonlight. You moonlight as a incredibly controversial public figure, even though what you're saying, and that video is a great example, seems to me like perfectly in line with, you know, basic Christian theology. But obviously, people don't like that.
Yeah, they don't like it. Well, I think there's a lot of people at the theological, religious level that essentially they assume that that Judaism, modern Judaism, is Christianity simply minus the New Testament, right?
Right.
So they think that, well, yeah, we have differences, and you know, Christians worship Jesus and Jews don't, but Judaism, out of all these other religions aside from Christianity, would be the closest to Christianity. So it's a lot of, you know, evangelical Protestant Christians, they acknowledge Judaism is not Christianity, but it's the closest. Whereas I would argue that in many regards, it's actually the furthest. Islam is, it's a false religion. And, you know, you can go back 1400 years of incredible conflicts between Christians and Muslims. And so I don't want to belittle the problems with Islamic teaching, especially as it pertains to Muslims religiously gaining more and more power here in the United States. That is a problem. So I don't want to minimize that. But the reality is that Islam still esteems Christ. So they're going to reject his deity. They're not going to see him as the way, the truth, and the life, as the only begotten Son of God, but still herald him and esteem him as a great prophet, close to, you know, or a similar level to Muhammad himself. Hinduism has a place for Jesus as esteemed. You know, Buddhism has a place for Jesus as esteemed. There's only one major world religion that actually despises Christ, that teaches that Christ is currently burning in hell, that views him as a heretic and a blasphemer and a false teacher, and that is Judaism. So the best way to think about it is when we read the Old Testament, we're not Marcionites, which is a heresy of really severing the new from the old, and reading the New Testament in isolation. That's your Christian, you know, liberal Christian who, you know, would be like, well, you know, but the red letters of the scripture, you know, say, and what they mean by that is that, you know, whatever Jesus said somehow eradicates everything in the Old Testament, that the Old Testament doesn't even exist anymore. Well, Jesus never talked about homosexuality. So therefore, you know, it's on the table. That, and that's just not basic Christian theology. We hold the old and new together. But the best way to think of it, there's one theologian who said that the Old Testament is like a richly furnished room, but dimly lit, but it can be fully appreciated in the light of the New Testament. And the way to understand Judaism in comparison to Christianity, Talmudic Judaism, modern Judaism, is that both of us share the Old Testament. The problem, though, is that they're not just the Old Testament minus the New. We both have lenses that are placed over the Old Testament to interpret it and understand it. We have the New Testament, and so we read the Old Testament through the New Testament as our lens. The Jew will read the Old Testament through the lens of the Talmud. And what the Talmud does is it doesn't just mean they have the Bible minus the New Testament. The Old Testament that they have is twisted and perverted and changed by the Talmud, that murky lens that they're reading the Old Testament through. So what you're left with in Judaism is not half of Christianity, but it's arguably the most hostile world religion to Christianity.
And that would be surprising for a lot of people to hear, because I feel like I'm constantly trying to remind people Judaism is not Christianity. I mean, nowadays there's this conflation where to even suggest that these are different religions with different worldviews and therefore different philosophies about what's right and wrong, people seem to not be able to recognize that. And they, like you said, want to treat Judaism like Christianity minus the New Testament. But even that phrase is a little absurd, right? I mean,
right. How
do you have Christianity without the New Testament? That really doesn't make any sense. So it is something utterly and completely different. And, you know, we see now the way that Christians in, you know, the Middle East and around Israel are being absolutely brutalized by the Israeli regime. I mean, and they just took over the settlers' field, which was the place where the shepherd's field, rather. The settlers took over the shepherd's field, which was the place where the shepherds were, you know, greeted by the angel who told them to go find Jesus in the manger. That is now, 1,000 people in that village were just violently expelled and taken over. So this is like, there's still a real world conflict going on here. This isn't just about ancient philosophy.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, the average Jewish person, whether they're practicing or not, that's another thing to point out is, you know, people will be quick to say, yeah, but the average Jewish person is not a religiously practicing Jew. Most of Israel is secular, and I recognize that. But what I think it's important for people to realize is you can say the same thing about America. So at this point, it's sad. But we really, as a nation, have apostatized against the Lord Jesus Christ, and we're not nearly as Christian as we once were. And yet, at the same time, all these Christian underpinnings are still there. So you have plenty of people who are never going to darken the door of a church on Sunday morning, and don't even, or if they do, it's twice a year. They're, you know, cultural Christians, something like that. Many of them won't even profess to be followers of Christ, and many of them are not truly regenerate. They're not born again. They're not Christians in any sense of the term. And yet, there are still cultural aspects in the West, in European countries, in America, that ultimately come from this Christian foundation. Well, it's the same thing. Apply that same concept now to Israel. And you can say, well, 75% of Israelis, you know, Jews living in Israel or Jews here in America, they're not practicing. They're not religious Jews. You know, Dave Smith would be an example, you know, or something like that. But what I would say is that in the same way that American culture, even modern present-day culture in America, was forged by Christianity, so too Jewish culture is forged by Judaism. Whether you acknowledge that or you're practicing or not, there's still the underpinnings that are still there. And some of those negative implications, I'm not saying that everything is bad about it, but some of the negative implications, the religion of Judaism, the best way to understand it is a religion of lawyers, a religion of litigation. No, it really is.
Because the Talmud is all arguments. It's all
right.
Actually, I'm a big fan of a YouTuber called Ash Mays, and you know, him describing it, and he's sort of defending the Talmud in certain ways, because people do, you know, you can find tracts of the Talmud that sound horrible out of context. In context, it's like, all right, maybe that wasn't quite what they're trying to say. But I mean, it's, you know, the way he describes it is like, imagine taking, you know, the transcript of legal proceedings for like a whole century in America and saying, this is your holy book now. You wouldn't know what people believed, because some people are making this argument, some people are making this argument. It's like, do they believe both? How could they? So yeah, I mean, the Talmud is very much a sort of lawyerish conversation about the Old Testament.
Right. It's a meticulous, legalistic litigation about the Old Testament. So when Jesus is constantly in the gospel narratives, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he said, you have heard it was said. A lot of Christians today, modern evangelical Protestant Christians, are really, at the end of the day, they're antinomians. And what that means, anti against, nomos, law. They're against the law of God. So they will read that and they think, oh, see, Jesus is actually contradicting Moses. Jesus is looking at the law of God that was given by God himself through Moses in the wilderness. And Jesus is saying, you know, God had a law and Moses said this, but I tell you But that's a break in the Trinity. It's as though the Son is somehow against his Father. Mm-hmm. When Jesus says, "You have heard it was said," what he's talking about is all the commentary, all the litigation, all the piles and piles of, well, actually, on top of Moses, that rabbis had piled up by even his time, much less our time, 2,000 years removed. So when Jesus says, "Well, the law said this, but I tell you," what he's saying is that Rabbi so-and-so, according to Rabbi so-and-so, according to Rabbi so-and-so, according to Rabbi so-and-so, in commentating and exegeting Moses, says that the application of this commandment given by God really means X, Y, and Z. But I tell you, right, when God says through Moses, "Do not murder," that this includes even murder at the level of the heart. Right. And so Jesus isn't, he's not disagreeing with Moses and therefore God who gave his law through Moses. Jesus is exegeting Moses, and what he's comparing and contrasting is his exegesis of Moses versus the Jewish rabbis' exegesis of Moses at that time. They were essentially, what they were trying to do is take the law of God and somehow lessen it, right? Like, if you swear by the temple, you're fine. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, then you're bound by your oath. Essentially, imagine a group of adult men, lawyers, who are basically coming up with a way of telling your dad, "Yeah, I'll do that, but nanny, nanny, boo-boo, I had my fingers crossed behind my back. I'm not really obligated. I'm not really bound." And Jesus is saying, "Well, wait a second. Is it the gold that makes the temple holy, or is it the temple?" No, I tell you. And so then he raises it. He doesn't lower the bar of morality. He raises and said, "Let your yes be yes and your no be no. If you give your word at all, whether you shouldn't swear by anything. The earth is God's footstool. Heaven is his throne. The temple is where he's worked. Give your yes and let your word be your word and keep it." Right? So Jesus is not pitted against Moses. Jesus is pitted against the litigation, endless legalistic litigation of lawyers who had perverted Moses to take God's law and lower it. Jesus comes in and raises it and applies it to the level of not just actions, but the heart.
Right. And it seems like any just honest reading of the New Testament, of the Gospels, that conclusion is sort of inevitable, right? I mean, he's not exactly vague about what he's trying to tell people. And, you know, the even well-known parables like the Good Samaritan, right? He's making the point, like, look, these amazing rabbis who do everything just right and are exalted and holy are actually less than the guy we're supposed to think is trash and, you know, equivalent of cattle, this Samaritan, which was a different racial group than the Jews that they were supposed to be arrayed against. And here's Jesus going, actually, he's the better guy because he's actually a decent person. Or, you know, you do all these forms of these ceremonies, and the actions of the ceremonies, the form of the ceremony, is supposed to just represent the transformation of your heart. He's saying it's that part that's important. So it's better that you genuinely feel regret for what you did and not perform the killing of the sacrificial chicken than killing of the sacrificial chicken and not regret, you know, your sin.
Right.
It seems very obvious to me when you read Jesus, he's directly rebuking the rabbis who are basically saying, as long as you fulfill the function, then it counts. And he's saying, right. No, you have to actually believe this stuff. That's what matters.
That's exactly right. The number one word that Jesus uses to describe as an indictment, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the lawyers, it literally says in the scribes and lawyers, these religious rulers at that time, is not legalist. And this is what people need to understand. Jesus does not go around to the Pharisees saying, "You legalists." No, he says, "You hypocrites. You're like whitewashed tombs, right? You're polished and white and clean on the outside, but on the inside, there's a rotting corpse that smells like death. You clean the outside of the cup, but on the inside, it's filled with germs. What's the point? The problem is not that you're too legalistic, that you make too much of the law of God. The problem is you're actually in direct rebellion to the law of God. You seem to give it lip service. You seem to tip the hat in your outward life, but your heart is actually far from the Lord. And now we have Christians today that look at this and they say, if any Christian pastor is preaching the law of God as though it's relevant and has application for Christians to follow today, he's just like the Pharisees. He's a legalist. No, Jesus' problem with the Pharisees was not that they were legalists. They were hypocrites.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned the fact that our whole civilization is built on Christianity and that's undeniable, but people are blind to it, like if, you know, fish is blind, would be blind to water. And like, I always think it's hilarious. I've heard atheists who have made their whole career about being atheists say, we don't need religion. All we need is the golden rule. And it's like, oh, Jesus's golden rule, the golden rule that Jesus said that it was so revolutionary they killed him over it. Mm-hmm. But they completely separate it and act like humans just come to this naturally. No, this was a revolutionary concept to treat others as you like to be treated.
Right. And with that, real quick, the Bible tells us this is why we need the New Testament and the Old, because the very question that immediately is raised from the golden rule, love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is one of two. So Jesus says, Matthew, you know, I believe it's 22 verses. Towards the latter part of Matthew, it's like four or five verses. He says, and he said to them, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, or heart, soul, and strength. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is like it, that you should love your neighbor as yourself. But then he finishes by saying all the law and the prophets, all the Old Testament moral commandments hinge on these two. So when you look at those two commandments, right, the golden rule being the second greatest commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself, the first, to love God, these two laws that Jesus gives are a summary of the Ten Commandments. So that the question that it should raise is, okay, love the Lord my God with everything, but how? Commandments number 1 through 4 in the Ten Commandments, have no other gods before me, do not make any graven images, don't take the Lord's name in vain, and remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do you just make up what you think is loving towards your neighbor, or did God write a book? Commandments number 5 through 10, the second table of the law, honor your father and mother, do not murder, commit adultery, do not steal, do not bear false witness, and do not covet. So it's not just do unto your neighbor as you would have him do. God actually lines out what that looks like. It's not just a blank canvas for our creative license and freedom. The Bible doesn't just say what to do. It tells us how to do it. And to understand that, you have to stop pitting Jesus against the Old Testament and realize that Judaism is not the Old Testament minus Jesus. It's the Old Testament corrupted and perverted through Jewish rabbis who are trying to wiggle their way out of obedience to God.
And again, the funny thing is, if you read the Old Testament, Jews are constantly falling out of favor with God. I mean, the most famous one is the, you know, worshiping the golden calf with Moses. I mean, Moses wasn't gone 5 minutes and they're worshiping a cow statue. So it's the idea that nowadays people, you know, act like if you criticize Israel or Jews or Judaism, that you're like in violation of some, you know, sacred commandment to, you know, never question them. But it's like, no, the whole story of the Jews is that they are fallen, just like we all are, and they fall away from God, and they're tempted away from him, and then God sends them a prophet to sort of set them right and try to get them back on track, and then they fall off again. So what you're saying is, again, not even like out of line with traditional, you know, Jewish history. This is what happens. And for a lot of Jews right now, I would say they've fallen off quite a bit. You look at things like the number one, the owner of the biggest pornography site in the world, the consortium of pornography sites, is a rabbi. And it's like, how could you possibly read the Old Testament with all of the beautiful language about chastity and virtue? And, you know, Solomon writes all these beautiful things about women and being protected. How can you possibly say that you are in line with the Old Testament beliefs and ideology when you're peddling smut? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. And well, that's part of the problem is, you know, even a guy like Dennis Prager, you know, he has said this publicly, and so I'm not making anything up, but he said that in the case of child pornography, if it's AI and not an actual child, that it would be permissible. Or, you know, adult pornography. He said that, if it's causing you to no longer desire your wife or to no longer be a loving husband, then that's a problem. But maybe, you know, you just have a greater sexual appetite than your wife, and, you know, and you're annoying her, you know, and so then it could actually be a way of loving your wife, and it's biblically permissible. And people, you know, Christians have talked to him about that and said, well, this is atrocious. What you're carving out, you know, moral grounds for pornography or AI kiddie porn. How could you do that? And what Dennis Prager has said is, you know, because Jesus says, if you lust after a woman in your heart, that you've already committed adultery. And Dennis Prager will be the first to point out, and I'm not saying he's particularly bad, but this is just a good example of the Jewish worldview. He's like, oh, well, see, that's not the Torah. That's not the Old Testament. But the whole point is that Jesus is taking Moses, thou shalt not commit adultery, and then giving us God's meaning of these are all the different practical applications of that commandment, the seventh commandment, to not commit adultery. And Jesus says, so you can commit adultery in deed. You can also commit it in thought. You can commit it in your heart. Same, do not murder. You can commit it in deed, but you can also commit it in thought and in your heart and your emotions and hatred towards other people. And the modern Jew, even guys who have done some good, like Dennis Prager, are exactly the people that Jesus is talking about. You are finding a way. The reason why you reject the New Testament is not because you're extra religious or extra, you know, holy. It's actually because you know that if you can just have the Old Testament, the Torah, apart from the New, and then litigate it through rabbis instead of exegeting it through Jesus, you can lower the bar of morality and get to harbor your sin.
Right. And again, it just seems obvious to me. How are you going to think about something all the time and not, you know, be tempted by it? Like, of course, you should not think about and allow yourself to fantasize about things that you aren't actually going to do. Again, that seems kind of obvious, but, and, you know, I like that you use Dennis Prager as an example, because he's obviously, you know, from everything I've seen, he's very, like, moral. He's very, you know, he probably wouldn't own pornography companies, but there are these sort of subtle differences that it's like, well, it's not so bad. And I remember growing up, like, I grew up, a lot of my friends were Jews, and like the Christians, our parents would tell us, like, you should wait till you're married to have sex. Like, it's a special thing, and that's what God wants. Sex is really only appropriate inside the bounds of marriage. Whereas my Jewish friends were told by their parents, hey, sex is an important part of marriage, and if you aren't compatible on a sexual level, it can cause a lot of problems. So actually, you want to make sure to sleep with somebody before you really commit to them, because otherwise, if you're not compatible in that way, you could be setting yourself up for a life of misery. You can choose whichever version you want, but these are sort of fundamental differences in that actually matter, and how your life plays out, and the choices that you make, and what you value in morality. So again, it's just this idea that, like, Judaism is not Christianity. And exactly. You can like either one, but the idea that somehow both of these things are exactly the same and Judaism is actually Christianity, but even better somehow, like that a lot of evangelicals especially tend to believe, it's important to, you know, identify, look, there are differences, and they might not be world-breaking, but they're substantial. And multiply them out 1,000 times, you know, for every person, change the way they act just a little bit, and you end up with major glaring gulfs of difference between right. These two groups.
And that's the whole purpose of the book, you know, The Hyphenated Heresy, Judeo-Christianity, which you can get on Amazon, and it's been doing really well. We've just released it a little bit over, I think 2.5 weeks ago, and we've already sold coming up on like 2,500 copies, which is great. It's, you know, self-published, but there's just an appetite for this content. But that was the big focus at the end of the day, is just helping people to understand. It's not that we hate all Jewish people or anything like that, but helping people understand that Judaism and Christianity, they're not one and the same. There is no such thing as Judeo-Christian. And people say, well, of course, as religions, they're distinct, and so there's no Judeo. But that phrase was just talking about our common virtues. And what we're articulating in the book is, no, even at the level of virtues and values and morals, Jews and Christians don't share that either. Just like you just said, your Jewish friends grew up hearing one set of morals from their parents. Christians grew up hearing a different. So even this idea of shared virtues, no, we don't have. It's like, well, we have the shared Ten Commandments. Correct, but we have the Ten Commandments explained by Christ in the light of the New Testament and how they apply even at the level of the heart. They have the Ten Commandments watered down with more obscurity and more loopholes by 2,000 years of lawyers trying right. to figure out, you know, a way to basically slip one past God. So religiously, this is different. Morally, this is different. And then we have a substantial section in the book talking about the way Judeo-Christian has been hijacked as a tool politically to right. get America and Western nations to be subservient to Israel, even against our own interest. And that's a big part of the book as well.
And that's why it's key to talk about this right now, because, you know, obviously, this isn't a religious show. We talk about politics, we talk about geopolitics, we talk about culture, and there are a couple major trends happening right now. One of them is the vicious and sort of brutal attacks against Christianity, and then sort of the countervailing push to criminalize anti-Semitism. I mean, this is not something that we can just, like, well, you don't talk about religion in polite societies. Well, it's having a direct impact on our freedoms, on our liberty, on where our money is going. So actually, we do have to talk about this, and we have to determine, you know, which set of values we want to follow, because you can't follow both. I think there's some guy that said you can't follow two masters. It's slipping my mind who that might have been. Of course, it was Jesus Christ, the Messiah, Son of God. We'll be back on the other side with Joel Webbin. We're actually going to come in with a little ad for his book. You'll get to see what it's all about, and we'll talk more about The Hyphenated Heresy.
Now, this new product is incredible. It's from our sponsor, Bigly, at thealexjonesstore.com. Optimal Human, you love the green powder. super nutrient, the very best out there. Well, this is optimal human nootropic called Mind Fuel. Introducing Mind Fuel, a super healthy, super strong energy nootropic adaptogen, which doesn't make you sick, doesn't have a letdown. It is incredible. Not just a few of the bottles. Look how many bottles are in there. And I only drink about half a bottle a day. It's so strong. Look at that right there, ladies and gentlemen. So that's what comes in each box of this. And it is simply amazing. Osmo Human Nootropic Mind Fuel is here. This clean, caffeine-free energy shot is designed for clear thinking, steady focus, and zero compromise. It's time to abandon sugary energy drinks and stimulant-heavy formulas in favor of clean, functional, nootropic-based energy. Zero calories, sugar-free, no crash, no blood sugar spike, can be used daily without any guilt. Caffeine-free formula, smooth, clean energy, ideal for caffeine-sensitive users and late-day use. It's also got all these other incredible compounds like citicoline, alpha-GPC, GABA, supports mental clarity and focus. It appeals to both biohackers and holistic consumers. High-quality electrolytes and B vitamins. More than a brain shot, true functional fuel. Optimal Human Nootropic Mind Fuel, that's the name of the product, isn't just another energy product. It's a smarter alternative for consumers who demand clarity, control, and clean performance without compromise. Get 25% off for life when you become a subscriber, canceling time for free. Get Mind Fuel down at thealexjonesstore.com. And if you've never tried the original superfood greens, Optimal Human, you really want to get this as well. It's the best green food I've ever had at thealexjonesstore.com. The widest selection of Patriot apparel, all sorts of cool collectible knives and more. And that's what funds us, and that's what does this. And I really appreciate your support because I can't do it without you. So I want to commend and thank the listeners. But just like I steered you right on gold and silver 2.5 years ago, I got out of the market before that. I said, now's the time. I was totally right. Just like I steer you right on politics. These products are incredible. Get our ultramethylene blue. It is the best in the market. Our Shilajit's the best. Our Irish Hemos is the best. Our turmeric is the strongest. Ultimate turmeric. TheAlexJonesStore.com. You are missing out. You don't get it. I want to thank those that have supported. I want to challenge those that haven't. What are you waiting for?
Just what I needed for my morning jog.
Working 12 to 13 hours a day, Mind Fuel keeps me on my toes and in the action.
Try this energy shot for a boost like no other. Power your mind and body today.
I am making this historic announcement on Friday, December 12th, 2025. The future of InfoWars hangs in the balance. It is in your hands. They're having a state auction in January next year in about a month, but we don't even have the money for payroll or for satellites or for bandwidth. We've got this next shot to survive, but if we don't get the funds in, we shut down. So we're selling 3 emergency limited edition posters at InfoWarsStore.com right now that are critical to us staying on the air. I want to encourage you to go now to get I Have Not Yet Begun to Fight, John Paul Jones poster, and 2 others, Make No Peace with Evil and Defend the West, Iconic Crusades. Go now to InfoWarsStore.com to get 1 or more of these iconic posters, limited edition. We cannot do it without you. I have fired the bat signal. Take action now if you want to stand with us in this fight at InfoWarsStore.com, and I salute you for your support.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Joel Webbin is my guest. He just wrote a book called The Hyphenated Heresy, Judeo-Christianity. You can find it on Amazon, right? Where else can they find it?
It's on Amazon, yeah.
You can get it on Amazon, and you can go to nrxstudios.com or follow Joel on X at Joel Webbin. And we're having some technical difficulties, but we're going to play the trailer for the book. That's very well done. You were seeing it there, but the audio wasn't coming in. So again, tell us who this book is for. Like, who would want to read this? Is it a heavy tome that you need to be in a scholar to read, or is this for your everyday reader?
No, we tried to encompass everybody. So the reading level is like – you know, I'm not an academic. So, you know, it's like probably like a ninth grade reading level. It's an easy, smooth read that you can just turn, you know, page after page after page, and enjoyable. But it is well footnoted. And so it's 250 pages. And, you know, on almost every page, you know, there's a good, you know, quarter of the bottom or a third of the bottom of the page with receipts and citations. So, you know, guys who want to look something up in the Mishnah, or they want to look something up in the Talmud, or they want to check this political politician that we cited or whatever, they can do that. So for guys who want not just the easy reading, but they actually want proofs, and they're trying to kind of build up their arguments, then it'll satisfy them in that regard. But if you just read it and you're not checking out every single footnote and all those kinds of things, it's a really easy read. It's an enjoyable read. And it's the kind of thing that you can give to your evangelical Zionist grandma. And she would like your grandma, who's like, you know, my greatest desire is that my grandson would go and die for Israel. You know, like that woman, God bless her. You know, she's the sweetest lady in the world, and she makes great cookies and all those kinds of things. She's in church every Sunday, and she's just been deceived by propaganda. You could give this to her, and she'll probably still want to support Israel and still think, well, politically though, they're still our greatest ally. But she would read this. She wouldn't throw it in the trash and call it anti-Semitic. And she would say, you know what, that actually was helpful, because at least religiously, I understand there's some big distinctions, and I can still be friends with Jews, but I definitely need to share the gospel with them and to preach Christ to them, because they're lost and they need Jesus.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking about it during the break, that like what we're saying, it's so funny, because like, you're a pastor, I'm a loving dude, I love Jews, and it's like some of my best friends are Jews, but like the conversation we're having could be perceived as like viciously hateful, and of course like the ADL would be writing articles about us, you know, saying all this stuff. But, you know, there's nothing that I say on the show that I wouldn't say to my Jewish friends. Like, you know, we have to talk about this stuff, and it's not hateful, and it's not mean, it's just the world, and you have to talk about it, especially when these topics are central to major global events, including
Correct.
The fact that right now, because I just saw the word Sinai on the back of this. You can talk about, you know, at the foot of Sinai, a nation met its God in thunder and fire. From that covenant flowed the faith of Abraham, Moses, and the prophets, fulfilled, not replaced in Christ. And now they're going to Mount Sinai with a new set of Ten Commandments as they're trying to usher in this unified, like, Noahide, whatever it is. But essentially, they're trying to fold the three big Abrahamic religions into a one-world religion, sort of stripped of its spirituality, but very useful in you know, getting what they want internationally. So,
right.
Again, it's important to understand, like, you can't let them try to, you know, degrade the differences between these religions, because at the end of the day, they're trying to fold them together. They're trying to destroy all three religions as they try to create a one world religion that, don't take my word for it, they're literally holding ceremonies on Mount Sinai announcing this and building a temple of Abrahamic faith.
And that's always important. What happens. It's funny that you mentioned that, Harrison, because I just finished reading, this is the second time now with I have five children, and it's our second time finishing the whole Narnia series by C.S. Lewis. And so we literally just finished the last two chapters of the last book, which is called The Last Battle in the Narnian series. There's six books. And we finished the last two chapters last night as I was reading to my children. And the big thing that in that book that is emphasized is there's the Kalorman, who C.S. Lewis describes. People even asked him in interviews, like, were you kind of talking about Muslims? And he's like, yeah.
Okay,
so
yeah, yeah.
He describes them as like darker skin and dark eyes and big beards, you know, and these kinds of things. And then the Narnians, who are like, you know, fair skinned, and they're, of course, you know, Narnia is symbolic of Christians, and Aslan is symbolic of Christ. But what happens is that one of the Narnians, a talking beast, but who is a Narnian, named Shift, he's an ape, but he's clever, but he's also deceitful and shrewd. He teams up with some of the leading Tarkans, some of the Calamans, and it's all actually political. It's not really, they use religious garb and religious language and rhetoric, but it's all to just get stuff at the end
right.
of the day. But the big idea that they come up with is that there's this false god of the Calormans called Tash. And then there's Aslan, who's the god of the Narnians, you know, and he's the Christ figure, Aslan the lion. And they say, well, really, you know, Tash and Aslan are the same god. And they start calling him Tashlin. Tashlin, and to get this pseudo unity between these two nations of Narnia and Calormen, and ultimately out of it to turn everyone into slaves, to get free labor and to get free stuff. And I'm like reading that last night to my kids, and I'm like, holy crap, Judeo-Christianity, you know, like,
yeah,
it's right there, you know. So
seriously, I mean, C.S. Lewis was tuned into some of that stuff, and you know, Narnia is great for kids, but man, you get into
it's so good for dads and moms.
It's amazing. I think last time you were on, I said the joke that C.S. Lewis is my pope, because I really do feel that way, and you know, he really does make the argument so powerfully. But you know, it's not a new thing. It's not something that they just came up with last year, going, hey, I know, what if we all were the same faith? Like, that's a good idea. No, these things have been in place for a long time. And you can see it in the way that certain sects will be vilified while others will be celebrated in Christianity or Islam or anything. It's often, you know, the dividing line is who's going along with the Mark of the Beast Antichrist system and who's not. So they hate Orthodox Christianity because it's the Orthodox, you know, Christian preachers who come out going, hey, this is the Mark of the Beast and we're not going for it. You know, Russian Orthodoxy, they're desperate to try to destroy and discredit these days.
I'm not Eastern Orthodox, and I'm particularly Western. And so there's big problems that I would have theologically and even culturally, but I got to give it to the EO bros, the Eastern Orthodox guys. They're based... those guys are not Zionists. Those guys, and they're also not feminist. There's a reason why a lot of young men have gravitated towards Eastern Orthodoxy, because you walk in, it's like Gregorian chants, you know, and all that.
It's beautiful,
and your priest is like barrel chested with a beard down to, you know, the buckle of his belt. And on Monday morning, you know, he's inviting all the men, you know, all the catechumens to come over to his garage, and he's like putting up 300 pounds on the bench press.
Yeah, yeah.
And in our feminized society, where you go to your evangelical church and it's Pastor Sally, you know, like a lot of young men are like, man, the theological distinctions, I don't really understand that. But what I do understand is this dude is a man and I need masculinity in my life.
Yeah. So. Again, it's funny because it seems so obvious, but somehow the churches are just in this death spiral where they're losing popularity. So they try to comport themselves to the modern, you know, society-wide moral degradation, and that just makes things worse. And it's funny because everybody from the outside can see it, but the churches just, they can't help themselves.
Right.
They keep going down this death spiral. And so it's not even like muscular, masculine Christianity. It's just like just Christianity that stands up for itself and that's strong and that says, this is who we are and we're not apologizing for it. And I'm sorry you have a different religion that disagrees with us. That's fine. Go over there and do that. We're not changing for you. That's all it takes. And I guess, you know, I guess call that muscular or masculine or whatever, but really it's just true belief. It's true faith. It's assertion and confidence. Why don't our churches have that?
It's what Christians have always believed, but something changed, you know, and I think we can kind of date it. I don't want to blame everything on this, but I think of 1948. There were waves along the way. Like, you can go back to the Enlightenment and see some of the things that crept into historic Christianity. You can go back to, you know, many different points in history where this happened and that happened, and there were cracks in the dam. But a big one was World War II. Mm. And this never again mentality. And I'm not an Adolf Hitler apologist or anything like that. But I do think that, you know, we came away from that with this mentality of a strong, convicted, authoritarian figure, you know, who uses Christian language, you know, and rhetoric. That's incredibly dangerous. And so what we need instead is we need Western societies, Europe and America. We need to be inclusive, right? We need to be accommodating. We need to be less dogmatic and more relativistic in the way that we hold our beliefs and our convictions. And what happened was that essentially we became vulnerable. We became vulnerable to false doctrines. We became vulnerable to false religion. We became vulnerable to mass immigration. We became vulnerable to all these different things. And at some point we need to be able to say, essentially it's like where we are today. It's like, why can the West not have nice things? Because of the Austrian painter with a funny mustache. And at a certain point, we have to be able to get over it. And getting over it, just for the record, I don't think it means lionizing, you know, Hitler. Getting over it doesn't mean like now I'm wearing a swastika. I wouldn't do that. When I say get over it, what I mean is there have been lots of very, very intense figures in history. You know, Genghis Khan, you know, Napoleon, like there's you know, lots of Stalin. But we have been operating under this cloud of fear and guilt, all in light of one person and one historical event. I call it Holocaustianity. Yeah. You don't have to be a Holocaust denier. I'm not saying that, you know, the only way to break the spell is to say that it never happened. You know, I would quibble a little bit with some of the numbers and some of the details. But when I say Holocaustianity, what I'm saying is that the Holocaust, regardless of how much of it is for sure, you know, fact, historical fact and true, the Holocaust has been weaponized into a religion. And essentially what that religion does, it asserts that that white Christian Westerners can't have a home. White Christian Westerners can't have dogma, convictions. White Christian Westerners have to just bend over and take it from the entire world. And that's political, that's religious, that's a spiritual weaponizing of World War II history. And I think that's where a lot of the problems came in.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And of course, I always put it that there's two Holocausts, right? There's the little H Holocaust, which was the, you know, tragic and systematic, you know, murder of innocent people by the Nazis, but, you know, it also occurred elsewhere in World War II. And then there's the capital H Holocaust TM, which is really has the characteristics of a religion. It has dogma that you have to assert. It has, you know, has certain things you have to believe. It has much more the, you know, characterization of a religion rather than a historic event. So I feel like you kind of
it's kind of gotten to that point where you'll see like a lot of evangelical Christians and pastors, you know, they're like, if you believe in your heart and confess with your mouth that 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust and that Jesus is Lord, then you will be saved. You
know, it's
please, sir, tell me which history of the Holocaust must I believe in order to be born again and saved, you know? And the reality is that, like, we're not relativists. There is something that's true and there's something that's false, and history does matter. So I'm not trying to trivialize it and say that none of it is important, but we've elevated that to the level of religious dogma, to where there's like I would never have someone coming to me as a pastor in my church and going through like our church membership process. And I would say, what's your view on Napoleon? And how many people did you think that he killed, down to, you know, the exact number? And if they didn't give me the right answers, I would bar them from membership in my church. But I know of evangelical pastors who actually would do that when it comes to World War II history. So there's lots of tragic events that have happened in the world. The world is fallen. It's filled with sin. But why is this one held almost comparable to the level of believing? Like, Christians do have to believe there are some non-negotiable historical facts we must believe. We must believe that 2,000 years ago, the life, the death, the burial, the resurrection, and the ascension of Jesus Christ, that he was born of the Virgin Mary, that he lived a sinless life, that he died not just as a moral example of sacrificial love for his friends, but he died as a Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. He died as a substitute under the wrath of God so that I might receive his righteousness and forgiveness. He bodily, not just in a metaphor or symbology, but bodily rose from the grave and has ascended to the right hand of God the Father, where he is seated and interceding on our behalf. And one day he will return to judge both the living and the dead. That's the history that a Christian must believe in order to be in the faith. That is the faith once and for all passed down to the saints. Everything else, it doesn't mean that everything else is relative. They're still true and they're still false. But everything else, it does not call your salvation into question to simply say, well, I kind of think Pat Buchanan was onto something. Right now, like Pat Buchanan, there are guys who are just reading, you know, The Fall of the West, you know, or like some of Pat Buchanan stuff on this event or that event, and they're being demonized by Christian pastors as though they were reading, you know,
Aleister Crowley or something.
Yeah, a satanic, you know, handbook.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's crazy and it's distorted and it's happened sort of subtly, and, you know, this sort of idea has been built up slowly but surely. But now at this point, I mean, especially when you talk about evangelicals, this, again, it goes out of the realm of religion into the realm of geopolitics when you have countries like Israel bringing over 1,000 pastors who deliberately indoctrinate them into imbuing their, you know, religious, you know, speeches with the geopolitical concerns of the state of Israel and trying to align those. It has become a very potent vector of propaganda for the state of Israel, the evangelical mission in America, which is also strange because at the same time, evangelicals are being viciously demonized in America. And I want to go to the clip of that in just a second. Before we do, let's go to the trailer, because I understand we have the trailer now. Awesome. Again, the book that discusses all of this easy to read but excruciating detail. I really like that, because you can just read it and just accept it if you want. But if you really want to dig in and interrogate these, you know, beliefs, then all of the footnotes are there. So it's sort of, you can read it whatever speed you want. But let's go to the trailer for this. Again, the book is Hyphenated Heresy, Judeo-Christianity. I had the dash, but that's the hyphenation, by Joel Webbin and Jordan Hall. You can get it now on Amazon. Here's the trailer.
At the foot of Mount Sinai, a nation met its God in thunder and fire. From that covenant flowed the faith of Abraham, Moses, and the prophets, fulfilled, not replaced, in Christ. But somewhere between the martyrs and the modern West, the truth was blurred. Politicians and pastors began speaking of a Judeo-Christian civilization. A phrase born not of Sinai, but in Washington, tracing its roots not to Moses, but to the Pharisees. The Hyphenated Heresy challenges the myth of the hyphen, tracing how it reshaped Christian identity, redefined the church's witness, and bound modern faith to political Zionism. Pick up your copy today on Amazon.com.
Wow, incredibly powerful. Man, absolutely fascinating. The Hyphenated Heresy, Judeo-Christianity, Joel Webbin and Jordan Hall. And yeah, I mean, of course, you know, it goes back to the Pharisees, but if you're talking about Israel, it goes back to the Rothschilds. I mean, this was a political move by, you know, bankers and elite, and they weaponized faith, and they weaponize all faiths in order to achieve this. You know, it doesn't mean that the people that live there are evil necessarily. The people that, you know, believe the religion of their fathers are, you know, deserve to die or whatever. It just means that you have to recognize this stuff not only in a spiritual and, you know, religiously significant way, but that it has impacts on modern politics.
Yeah, very political implications. You need to recognize that Judaism, religiously speaking, is not Christian. That's the spiritual side. You also need to recognize that Israel is for Israel. And that doesn't mean that we should be at war with them. That doesn't mean that, but we do need to understand that our interests are our interests, and that's separate from what Israel is trying. Like we need to seriously call into question: is it in American interest to send, you know, bunker buster missiles into Iran and agitate, you know, countries in the Middle East? Does that help America? You know, it's like, well, they're about to have nukes. Well, for 30 years, they've been two weeks away from having nukes. And even if they have the nuclear with uranium and those things, I've looked into that somewhat extensively. Matt Gaetz has talked about this. They didn't have the missile projectile technology to ever be even close to reaching America. They're not a threat to us. They're not a threat to us. But what happens is that the religious piece comes in, and then the emotional appeal comes in, and it's like, well, we've got to go help them. But then what happens is that you have people on the other side of the world chanting death to America. And what a lot of Americans don't realize, and then it foments the anger towards Muslims. And they're like, well, Muslims hate us. They're chanting death to America. They're burning American flags. Well, guys, like, let me be honest with you for a second. The reason they hate America is because Israel has made their lives a nightmare. And they know that Israel gets their strength. The reason Israel can stay in business is because of America. A lot of Muslims on the other side of the world, their hatred for America is actually because of our partnership with Israel. It's not because they just innately are like, you know, this country on the other side of the world, that doesn't affect me whatsoever. I hate them and I'm burning their flag. No, it's because we do affect them. We are helping Israel, and like, oh, we'll drop a bomb over here. We'll do, you know, a little regime change over there. We'll do. And so but all of it, what's underlining, it's like, why does America have this, like, what seems like a religious fervor, religious devotion to this? Well, it's because it is religious.
Yeah.
It is religious. And that's what we're trying to point out.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't even necessarily begrudge the Jews for doing a lot of the anti-Semitism stuff. Like, sure, you don't want people talking trash about you, and you want to, you know, speak out about that. you know, more power to you. Well, of course, when it gets into the tyranny and they're lying about it and they're saying, oh, it's anti-Semitism, when really you're just talking about Jeffrey Epstein or whatever, obviously that's wrong and it can be very easily manipulated. But it's, you know, it's the case with a lot of stuff that, that Jews are accused of. And I always talk about talking to my friend who was Jewish, and I asked him if he was going to stay in town or because he was getting a new job. And he said, well, you know, I'm Jewish. You know, we're not that many people. I can basically get a job anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world, I'm probably one or two degrees of separation from somebody in London or Jakarta that could get me a job. It's just, you know, the way the Jewish community works and operates and whatever. And it's like, you know, what am I supposed to say? Don't do that. You know, right. Don't take advantage. No, it's, you know, whatever. But, you know, when you weaponize it, and the point I'm saying this is I don't necessarily begrudge them wanting to defend themselves, but we also have to defend ourselves.
Right.
And the lies and smears about Christianity that are happening today, they're not – you know, nothing. You have to confront them and say, this is bad and evil. And this is not just a, you know, an opinion about a religious group. It's a lie, an attempt to demonize and dehumanize a group of people, probably because you intend to do them harm. And I have a video of this. I hadn't watched it until I saw it on Alex's show, but it's crazy. Let's go to it and we'll comment on the other side.
So when you think about the Erica Kirks, the Life Church, the Joel Osteen of it all, and their desire to accumulate wealth while hoodwinking their flock into thinking they're super moral. This is a cancer. White evangelical Christianity is a cancer. These are the worst of our country. These are the worst people in our country because they use their religion in two ways, as a weapon and as a shield. They weaponize it whenever they want to. And say, we're on the moral high ground. You're a lesbian. You deserve to die. You're a lesbian. The cops shouldn't have revived you. Oh, your parents are Mexicans and they brought you over here. Yeah, you should go to jail and eat worm food.
All right. Let's just pause it right there because we can't let these things pass. I mean, what the hell is she talking about? What Christian says she's a lesbian? She deserves to die. I mean, it's just flagrant blood libel is what that is.
Yeah, she's trying to incite people against Christians. I have to go on record and say I don't like Joel Osteen either.
Right.
I don't like Life Church either. And I do think that there are charlatans within the evangelical church who do fleece the flock. And, you know, like, hey, if you give me all your money, you know, then you'll be blessed by God. You know, there's literally a term for that. We call it the prosperity gospel. It's the health and wealth gospel that ultimately says, like, if you trust in Jesus and, you know, wish really hard upon a shooting star, you know, then all of your dreams will come true. And that's not what the Bible teaches. So that is a false teaching and it's damnable. And so I have a huge problem with that. But you can tell that if that's all she said, if she just had a problem with the prosperity gospel as a heresy and the way that it preys on the poor, fine. But that's... she's using them because people like Joel Osteen are low-hanging fruit to get to her real target. And her real target is, she said it, white evangelical Christians, all of them. She's not just concerned about T.D. Jakes or Joel Osteen or, you know, somebody who's, you know, Joyce Meyer, who's teaching the prosperity gospel, Benny Hinn. She is concerned with white evangelical Christians. And then what she describes, like what she's saying right there is the lesbian thing, they're bigots. The Mexican thing, they're racist. And she's describing, you know, a person that by and large doesn't really exist.
Right.
Most evangelicals, when I talk to them, because I, you know, I believe that race is real. And I believe it matters. I'm not a race essentialist. I think that, you know, our faith in Christ is paramount, religion first. But when I talk to people about race, they don't have a racist bone in their body.
Absolutely. It's anti-Christian. Folks, Joel Webbin, The Hyphenated Heresy, Judeo-Christianity. Get it at Amazon today.
I'm here to announce a new, extremely exciting product at the alexjonesstore.com, and that's MindFuel. Brought to you by the same folks that developed Optimal Human. This is an Optimal Human product. We set out with our sponsor, Bigley, to come out with a clean, nootropic energy shot that doesn't have any letdown, but gives you clean energy. This stuff is so strong, though, I take half a shot in the morning. It's a big shot. And another half in the afternoon if I need to work late. But again, you can still sleep on it because it's not a traditional stimulant. So if you loved Optimal Human, the strongest, best, super nutrient-packed green drink out there, available right now at theeltrashore.com, you are going to love Mind Fuel. And when I go through these ingredients, go research these for yourself and then know, when you find out how great they are, that we have the very best and the very strongest in this product, Mind Fuel, available right now at theallshowstore.com. Nootropic Mind Fuel is here. This clean, caffeine-free energy shot is designed for clear thinking, steady focus, and zero compromise. It's time to abandon sugary energy drinks and stimulant-heavy formulas in favor of clean, functional, nootropic-based energy. Zero calories, sugar-free, benefit, no crash, no blood sugar spike. Advantage can be used daily without guilt and is good for your whole body, not just your brain. Caffeine-free formula, smooth, clean energy. Advantage, ideal for caffeine-sensitive users and late-day use. Nootropic Alpha GPC, Citricoline, DMAE, GABA. Benefit supports mental clarity and focus. Advantage competes with premium brain formulas in a convenient shot. And the best part is, it's an adaptogenic and herbal proprietary blend. Balanced, grounded energy. Advantage appeals to both biohackers and holistic consumers. And then it's got high-quality electrolytes and a spectrum of high-quality B. If you love our other products, thealexshowstore.com, you are going to love Mind Fuel. And if you haven't tried our Ultra Methylene Blue or our Shilajit or Irish Sea Moss or our Bovine Colostrum, you're crazy. These are all incredible products. Get your Mind Fuel now at thealexshowstore.com and help keep us on the air on Powering Your Life.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.